It's currently 10:24 a.m., August 10th, 2022. We are in the Cucumber Magnolia Gene Bank, and I am interviewing Chris Early for the Hear Hear Arboretum Project. All right. So first, what is your name and what do you do / what is your affiliation with the Arboretum?
So my name is Chris Early. I am the interpretive biologist and education coordinator here at the Arboretum. I'm in my 30th year of working here full-time, and I was a student volunteer before that during my undergrad.
And describe what is in front of you / what you see currently.
So what we're looking at right now is the cucumber tree or cucumber magnolia section of the gene bank that's part of the Arboretum rare woody plant program.
Okay, and what happened here?
So what we've done, and when I say we, I mean people that were here before me, Arboretum staff went around to Southern Ontario, all across Southern Ontario, especially in Carolinian zones, and collected native seed from rare woody plants. And so these are some of the plants that are from that seed collection, and they've been planted and cared for and then planted out here so that they can grow large and can start sort of crossing with each other. And that way we get a genetically diverse as well as a nice sample of seeds so that we can use those seeds for possible rehabilitation projects, because the genetics of these trees are the same as the genetics of where they are found in the wild in Ontario.
And so what experience here happened specifically to you?
So one of the things that I remember about standing here with cucumber magnolias is working with Henry Koch, who was one of the first people to be working on this project. And he was a super guy and very insightful. And him telling me about cucumber magnolias and the fact that some of their population in the wild in Ontario is now gone. But we actually collected seed from that population before it was destroyed. And that's super meaningful that we still have the genetics of that population before it got chopped down to become a subdivision, because in rehabilitation projects in that area, we can still bring trees back that have the same genetics. And so learning that from Henry was really, it was a very special time to learn about not just the fact that we're saving trees, but we're saving them in a really thoughtful way by thinking about their genetics. Because you can get cucumber trees, they grow all the way down into the States, in Carolinian areas in the States. But if we took one of those trees and brought it up here, it's not gonna do very well because it's not adapted to the northern conditions. Whereas these individuals are adapted to northern conditions. And so it's a really great project, and something that, especially now, native species have much more sort of, not that they weren't valued then, but they're more valued now by the general public because people are more green now than they were then. And so it's great that we were able to do that back in the 70s and now be able to show the fruits of all that labor by the actual fruits that are coming out on the trees.
Were you aware of this problem back like in the 70s when you first started?
No, so I didn't start. I started here in the early 90s. And I knew that there were rare plants, but I didn't know specifically about some of those plants. And so I learned that, for example, cucumber trees were Canada's first endangered tree species, because they're really rare. So yeah, I got to learn that when I started working here.
Is there a reason why they're endangered? Like, do people cut them down?
Yeah, so they're in a restricted area. So Carolinian Canada is sort of just a small strip of forest that's sort of southern areas of the Great Lakes and up sort of along the north shore of Lake Ontario. There's this zone, this forest zone called the Carolinian Forest Zone. And so they only grow in that zone. And because that zone is so intensely used for agriculture and where a lot of our large cities are and that type of thing, there just isn't as much habitat as there used to be. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the problems that they have.
So do you remember, like, specifically how your conversation with Henry Koch made you feel?
It made me feel sad that there were trees that were endangered, but it made me feel a little bit empowered that the Arboretum was doing something about it. Mm-hmm. And that's continuing today with the great horticultural staff that we have now, that they're still working on this project that, you know, is, mm-hmm. you know, becoming decades and decades old. And that's something that's important for doing tree research. It takes a long time because the trees take so long to grow and mature. So it's a very, you have to really look far into the future to see how something like this might be important.
So how do you get involved with the Gene Bank project?
Like for other people to get involved?
No, or? Like how did you get involved?
Oh, I got involved mostly because I'm the educator here at the Arboretum. I may bring groups out here to the Gene Bank to talk about genetic diversity. Mm-hmm. So my staff and I sometimes bring high school groups out here, for example, and teach them that, you know, identifying trees is important, but understanding the tree's natural history and its conservation status is really important too. And so that's what I use the Gene Bank for in my job, is to show people what we're doing here in hopes that they may want to continue that work somewhere else, or just have a better understanding that rare woody plants are important. And who knows, they may end up becoming someone that may want to make a donation to the Gene Bank in the future.
So when you started in the 1990s, was the Gene Bank already like open for educational groups, or was it still like only for researchers?
For most of it back then, we were focusing mostly on research. We didn't, and you can see even now, we don't have like a whole bunch of signage here. So we're not deterring people from coming to look, but we're not trying to get people to spend a lot of time here, just because we want the trees to sort of be on their own. We don't want anyone to be picking their fruits or their seeds, because we want to use those for future projects and that type of thing. But after I started here, we realized that the trees are starting to look impressive, and now's the time to start really showcasing them in hopes that we can get more funding to continue our work.
Mm-hmm. So how did your first like conversation with like Henry Koch, when he introduced you to the cucumber magnolias, mm-hmm. like do you remember how that took place?
I think we were just we did work together on a brochure on rare woody plants. So we actually used to have a brochure that talked about the project, and I think it was probably as we talked about that. So I was making the brochure, but he was my main resource person for getting the information for the brochure. And so because he did a lot of our educational programming as well, and so we just worked together, and that's probably how all of that came about, by just walking around with him and learning from him about mm-hmm. these trees.
Would you happen to know where like that copy of the brochure could be found, or is it?
I think I probably have a copy of that. Mm-hmm. So what I can do is I'll scan it for you, mm-hmm. Or take a photo of it mm-hmm. and send it to you.
All right, thank you so much. So when you first came here, like focusing on like that first conversation with like Henry Koch about the cucumber magnolias, how had that location changed since then, or how did it look like back then?
Yeah, so I mean, back then that was almost 30 years ago, right? So these trees were a lot smaller, so they certainly weren't as impressive as this. But other than that, the site, except for the growing up of trees all around the site, like the whole edge here, the trees are all larger, especially some of these conifers, which would have been quite tiny when we were first here. The site it's the same, but yeah, everything has just grown, which is neat to see in your career, to be able to see that this looks different than when I was an undergrad, for example.
So like how tall were the trees back then? Do you remember?
Oh,
a foot?
They were taller than that, but they weren't a lot taller than these trees. So, they were probably, I'm trying to remember. They were probably like sort of 6 to 7 feet, maybe 2 to 3 meters tall.
So like by that time they had been planted for 20 years or so, less than?
I'm not sure when they had been, like when these ones were actually put here. So I'm not positive. They may have been, just looking at the size of some of these, I think some of them may have just been newly planted here.
Like going back to like Henry Cock, like what was your relationship with him like in the Arboretum staff?
Yeah, so Henry, so I was the interpretive biologist or interpretive naturalist. So I was sort of there to interpret nature, and he was the interpretive horticulturist. So his job, besides helping plan collections and that type of thing, was teaching people about them. So he did more of the plant and gardening and horticulture side, and I did more of the nature and wildlife and often more of the kid program side. So yeah, so we worked together on that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So did he focus mainly on like research then, if you focus on
He had more of a research side to his position certainly than I did. I still do research from like bird survey, that type of thing. Whereas he was doing research on these gene banks for sure.
Oh, what are bird surveys? Like
yeah, so for example, right now doing a bird survey, you do them by sound. And so I would stand here and in 100-meter radius, I would write down the birds that I'm, if it was the breeding season. So for example, there's a crow over there. There's a eastern phoebe that direction. There's a goldfinch singing behind us. There's another goldfinch singing or calling the opposite side. Mm-hmm. A chickadee just flew by over there. Another goldfinch just flew over. There's a flicker farther away that direction. So yeah, so that's the type of thing you would just do. And these are things, it's fun because mm-hmm. if you were just using your eyes, mm-hmm. then, well, that chickadee would have been the only thing in the survey, but there were all kinds of other things making sounds. So mm-hmm. so that's the type of thing that I would have do research-wise for the Forest Bird Monitoring Project or the Arboretum Summer Bird Survey or Winter Bird Survey, that type of thing.
So do you learn any like skills in this location or like at your time at the Arboretum that's like stayed with you?
Yeah, so I would have learned things like how to identify a cucumber magnolia, what their fruits look like. I'd start looking at what maybe caterpillars might be found on a cucumber magnolia. So in one of these, so some of the gene bank plants aren't right in the gene bank, they're planted in different spaces. And so on the other side of this sort of natural wildlife corridor, that way farther in our World of Trees collection, we have some of these cucumber magnolias growing. And I was doing a tour with the Wildlife Club for Frosh Week about 5 years ago, and someone found a caterpillar on the cucumber magnolia, and it was the first time we've seen that, and it's a giant moth when it turns into a moth, and it was the first time that we'd seen a Promethea moth in the arboretum. And now they're still not common, but we still find them, but that was the very first one, and it was found by an undergrad student during a Frosh Week hike, which was pretty fun. So mm-hmm. yeah.
Do you remember like what smells or what sounds like sensory cues back when you were here during that like initial conversation with like Henry Cock?
No, I would have, I'm trying to think what time of the year we would have had, like would have talked about that type of thing. But yeah, I can't think of what, the smells probably would have been similar to what they are now. Mm-hmm.
So like going back to the background of the conversation, so like mm-hmm. at that time,
yeah.
Were there other, like, were you aware of like other trees in the gene banks, or was that your first time hearing about the project?
I'd read about it, and I'd heard people talk about it. I don't think it was my first time actually in the site, but it was probably the first time where I've walked through the site, with Henry. And it was also part of, because I was, for this brochure, I was sort of mapping out where the sites were. I wanted to know what species were growing in the site. So I was aware that there were blue ashes, for example, being planted in the site. You know, all kinds. There were about somewhere but around 25 species of rare woody plants that we were actually growing in the actual gene bank sites.
So, like, at that time when you were, like, walking through the sites, were you aware of, like, I think it was, I think you mentioned it, like in an article, or maybe it was Sean Fox, how, like, you were stewards of the Arboretum.
Right.
Stewards of nature.
Yeah.
So, like, at that time, did you realize, like, the impact of this project and, like, the legacy of it?
I had an inkling that this was super important, for sure. I mean, you know, when you're young, you may not think about things, like, sort of in that terms, but I knew that it was important that we were saving the genetics of these trees, because it's sort of obvious, right? Mm-hmm. If we're growing a tree that its parents are gone in the wild, but we still have it here, that's a pretty big deal, right? Like, it's an important stewardship project for the Arboretum, and something that, like, the genetics of the trees that we grow in the gene bank have been spread all over Southern Ontario now, because we sell them in our, like, we actually sell endangered species, which is illegal, right? So it's kind of a funny thing when you think, you know, I couldn't go up and say, hey, do you want to buy a panda or, you know, how about this tiger cub, right? But we do sell an endangered tree species in Canada. And it's a bit complicated, because everyone always looks at endangered species from an animal standpoint. But when you look at the plants, having some of these genetics out there growing in someone's front yard is a good thing for that population. Because if, suppose there was a tornado here and it knocked down all of our cucumber magnolias, we could go, oh, remember Bill bought one of them from the plant sale, and he's growing it in his backyard. And you could go and get the fruits maybe from that one. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's actually a great way of ensuring that these plants are going to survive some type of disaster.
So are there no regulations around, like, selling endangered plants?
Yeah, we actually contacted the government when the Species at Risk Act sort of came out. We contacted them and we said, so we're selling endangered species. Oh, there goes an endangered species right there, that monarch butterfly. We're selling them, and that's not allowed. So what should we do? And they didn't know what to do, because it didn't fit in their categories, because they could tell that what we were doing was smart, but all their laws said we shouldn't do what we were doing. So they actually just sort of glossed over it and didn't contact us. We just said, we're going to keep doing this until you tell us what we should be doing. And of course, I think it was one of those government things where someone was smart enough to go, following the exact rules here is dumb, so let's just forget that we even know about this. So I think that might be why, because they know that the work we're doing is so important.
So what's the current status of, like, the cucumber magnolia?
So it's still an endangered species in Canada, but now it's not the only endangered woody plant. So there are lots of other plants that are on either special concern, threatened, or endangered list.
Yep.
And we grow most of those here, because most of them are found in Southern Ontario.
Like, I was, like, doing my research, and under, like, the species, like, the Endangered Species Act, they're, like, yep, the different, like, levels.
Right, exactly.
So, like, would this be, like, at a higher priority?
So endangered species is at the highest priority.
Yeah. Yep.
And then just below that would be threatened species. Mm-hmm. So they're in a position where if things don't change soon, they are going to become an endangered species. Mm-hmm. And then there's special concern, which are lower down than that, mm-hmm, which, you know, and some of these things are reevaluated every so often. So cucumber magnolias, for example, have been reevaluated, but they stayed at the endangered status that they were at, because their populations are not increasing in such a way that they should be removed from the endangered list.
Do you know how many there are in the wild? Approximately?
No. But that number is out there. I just can't remember. I can't remember what the number is. But the number is out there, because they have done quite a few surveys about them, at least for mature individuals. But it's, you know, it's, I think it's in the, like, low hundreds. So, yeah. So, but, you know, you should check that for sure. But it's certainly not very many.
like, also, like, when I was doing my research, I was very surprised, since, like, the Species Act only passed, like, in, like, the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And, exactly. And like, before that, like, the agency that like, controlled, like, the plant species, mm-hmm. that was only founded, like, in the late 90s.
Yeah.
So, before that was, like, the Gene Bank Project created just out of, like, just because it was, like, a purpose that someone, just, right. just, like, just because it was a project that someone saw the need to do,
right.
or was it influenced in, like, any way by, like, external policies or external
right.
organizations?
So there was still, but even before that, there was CSEWIC, which is the Committee on the Status of Endangered mm-hmm. Wildlife in Canada. And so that would have, that's the list that the cucumber magnolia was on as an endangered species. So that still existed even before some of these detailed policies came out. And it was because of that that the project was started here at the Arboretum. So we knew that this was important. And the project was called Picking Up the Pawpaws. And pawpaws are another rare plant in Southern Ontario. And so there were policies out there. They just weren't as polished as, say, the Species at Risk Act or that type of thing. But research that happened way back then influenced some of those acts. So, yeah. So we were still working with guidelines that helped us decide what plants to put in the gene bank.
So it's like, I read a paper by Sean Fox.
Yep.
And he basically described, like, the history of, like, the Pick Up the Pawpaws
yep.
project.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying how like John Ambrose
yep.
that had
yeah, yeah.
the idea to, like, initially start yep. mm-hmm. going around, like, Southern Ontario and
right.
like looking for pawpaws.
Yeah.
So was that, like, at that time, so that was, like, the mid-70s, I think,
yep.
or, like,
mm-hmm.
early 70s.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
At that time, was the pawpaw, like, already a recognized species that was, like, at risk, or was that simply only known to, like, researchers?
I think it was probably on the CSEWIC list. Mm-hmm. It wasn't at the endangered level, but they knew that it certainly wasn't common, and that's what sort of started the whole thing, where they started doing, you know, all the other species as well. So yeah.
Also, like, do you know if the gene bank has had any impact on policies, or if it's, like, appeared as, like, a highlight or, like, a footnote of policies?
Yeah, so a lot of, like, people know what we do here, and so they highlight the fact that we work on different programs that promote genetic diversity from this northern population. Plus, people who are doing rehabilitation projects in Southern Ontario may come to us to get seed, so that either they can use that to rehabilitate, or they use that seed to start growing other plants that can be used for rehabilitation projects. Mm-hmm. So it is very well known that we're doing this here.
And since I'm pretty sure that this was the first gene bank in Canada,
mm-hmm.
Like, do you know if there's any others that's, like, popped up since
then? I think there are other research facilities that are growing things like this mm-hmm. now. But yeah, it was a pretty innovative idea mm-hmm. for us to be doing this so early, at least at the scale that we mm-hmm. were doing it at, for sure.
So, like, at the scale, there's only Guelph or the Arboretum that's doing it at this scale? At least in Canada?
I'm not sure. There are probably, I'm sure there are other arboreta that are doing this, but I don't know of any that are doing it at the same sort of scale or same, like, there's also the difference that we know where that cucumber magnolia that's right beside us, we know where that seed came from,
mm-hmm.
right? So some other places may be growing things, but they may not know all the details mm-hmm. all the way back to the mid-70s on where the population came from. And that's something that sets us apart too, is we have, from a research standpoint, we have all that data because we kept track of it all, mm-hmm. which is pretty neat. And back then, a lot of other arboreta and arboretums, they would focus on showcasing trees and shrubs and vines from all over the world, whereas we do that here, but we did a lot of focusing on native species, and back then that wasn't as popular to do. Mm-hmm. It was more popular to have, you know, something from Southeast Asia or something from, you know, from Italy or something like that. Whereas we, you know, we are a smaller arboretum, but that sort of helped us because we couldn't do that as big of a scale as other places. That may have helped us decide, well, why don't we do native plant research And that really got things going.
So are all like the session numbers like in a database somewhere?
Yeah, we've got it all. Every tree, if we go to these trees, of course I'm not going to be able to find one now, but every tree has a tag on it.
Oh.
And that tag has the number. And of course I can't find them. But they're all GPS now too. So we know where each tree is on this GPS system, but every tree has a tag, and that tag has an accession number, and that actually links back to all the information where the seed was collected, when the seed was planted, when the seedling would have been planted out here into the gene bank, that type of thing.
Since like before, I was looking at the Arboretum Explorer, like the map, like the interactive map, and I was like trying to find the location of this gene bank again.
Right, yes.
So like I knew that it was a blue ash, like the gene bank over there.
Yeah.
So like I typed up blue ash in the Explorer, and there were like none in that area. There were like several others like around it, but it wasn't showing up in the gene bank section.
Right.
So like it's like, are these trees excluded from the Explorer?
We're trying not to advertise that all of this stuff is here, because we don't want someone to come and collect the seed on us. So but we are showcasing all these trees in other places, and so that's why you would see them in other spots. Yeah,
but like in your personal, like in the Arboretum's personal database, like all these trees would
all that information is there. Yeah, everything. It's we have basically any tree that was planted here is in that database. We have all the information about all these trees.
Do you know how many trees are in the database?
Oh, that's a
thousands
question. No, that would be we should find out what the actual number is. Oh, definitely thousands. Oh yeah, well yes, for sure, thousands and thousands. But yeah, that's a great question. I should find out what the actual number is right now, because of course it keeps increasing, right, because we keep planting more trees. So
do you know how many trees you normally plant per year, or like per like semester?
No, and some of that would depend on some of the projects that we're working on that year. But we do for the Wall Custance Memorial Forest Program, for example, we plant individual trees for individuals as a like a memory of a lost loved one. And so that, you know, that's hundreds each year just for that one project. Yeah.
What happens if the Arboretum runs out of space?
Yeah, so then we would try and find other sites where we may be able to continue the program. But that hasn't happened yet, so we're hoping that doesn't happen. But we are, it's also, we can't maintain, if we go too crazy, we can't maintain everything, right?
Yeah.
So we have to realize we have a small staff, and so time is, it's important to be efficient. So we have to have enough trees for the research to make sense, but not go too crazy, because we can't then maintain everything.
All right, for just follow-up questions, do you have any other experiences in this location? Besides the initial one where you talked about the conversation with Henry Cobb?
Right. I have talked to, Nokum's house, which is sort of grandmother's house, which is an indigenous project that's happening in the Arboretum. So we have walked through here with different people connected with that project just recently, and pointed out things to them, because the site for that is just actually on the other side of that bank of conifers. And so I've gone around here with them and pointed out different bird species that are utilizing the site, so that they know what type of things they may be seeing once the building is over there and students are using it. So that would be something that's happened just recently. And it's nice, because people, you know, when you talk about an endangered tree species, people are usually pretty interested, because they've heard about all these endangered wildlife species, but they never think about the fact that, you know, this tree, right, could be endangered. It's pretty fun. And same reaction that you had. They go, look at the size of these leaves. Where are these trees from? And you say Ontario, and they're, what? We have trees that are this tropical looking. And this is our only native magnolia species in Canada. So it's the only native magnolia species. So the States has more, I think, but this is the only one that's found north of the border.
Wait, so going back to like Nokum's house, like is it like the house that's like by the farm location?
No, it hasn't been built yet. But it will, yes, it will be going near near the organic farm. So it's on that sort of area that they're going to be building it.
So like, were you pointing out the birds because like the birds that are like special to the indigenous community?
I was just pointing out the birds. I think they're all special to the indigenous community. And they just, because they want to know about the site, because, you know, it may link to different things for that building or for programs that they may be doing. Mm-hmm. And it's just nice to know what's around. And they're super keen about knowing all that stuff. So, so that was sort of a fun thing to walk around this area and point that type of thing out to them.
Also, I know that I asked you this before, but regarding like what is your connection to the Arboretum, has it changed over time?
My connection to the Arboretum? Yes. Yeah, so it's changed a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm more and more and more connected to it. I mean, this is the only full-time permanent job I've had, right? So I've worked at other places, but most of my full-time life has been here. So the longer I'm here, the more connected I am of it. So I get a little defensive of it. I want people to know about it. So I'm thrilled to talk to people about it. But if something's threatening it, I'm also ready to try and stop any type of threats that's happening to the Arboretum. Because this is an amazing thing to have, like a university that part of their campus is a 400-acre Arboretum. And luckily, lots of people on campus are, if they didn't know before, they're starting to realize that this is a huge asset to them, especially since we're such a small staff. It's not a huge money sink. We have to be self-supportive. So a lot of, for part of our funding has to come from stuff that we raise funding for. So I think it's a pretty good deal for the university to have this site as part of their as part of their campus, both for undergrads and graduates and faculty, as well as the other staff, just from a mental health standpoint, being able to come out here, no matter what program you're in, the Arboretum, I consider it sort of like the library. It's for everyone. And so everyone should be out here utilizing it.
That's a really nice metaphor.
Yeah.
Like in my interview last week with Roof, like I asked her, like, how has the Arboretum changed? And she got like sentimental about like how the fact like when she came here, it was an open field, so it was nice to like for the Arboretum to grow as she grew.
Right.
So like as she grew older, the Arboretum fully like sprung up.
Yep. When I was an undergrad here, I mean, all of this was an open field, right? So it's amazing what like in, well, I guess as I started, so 3.5 decades, how you can change something for the better. It's pretty cool.
Also the fact that like it's like the Arboretum's 50th anniversary this year or last year?
It happened of course at the start of COVID. So it was 2020. So we were doing big things and then that sort of wrecked it. So maybe we'll do like a big 55th or something like that. But
But it's wild to think like 50 or 52 years ago, this was not here.
And if you look at aerial photographs of the site and the differences, it's huge. It's amazing. Like, it's really quite amazing. Yeah.
So you mentioned this before, but what makes the Arboretum special as a green space for you?
I think it's because anyone can come here. It's important for campus, but it's also important for the Guelph community and beyond that. We have a really great focus on educating people here, as well as providing research, as well as providing a site for community members. And so that's our triangle of focus, is to have the research covered, have the education covered, and have the community outreach covered. And that's what I think is what makes this place so meaningful. It's not a provincial park. It's not a national park. It's not a conservation area. We're sort of in our own little realm of what we are, but it's amazing. So for example, the pandemic that we were just talking about, in 2020, the provincial parks all shut down, the national parks all shut down, the conservation areas all shut down. And suddenly we were the only place that stayed open. and it was bananas here. Like, our parking lots were full. People were parking along the sides of the road because you can see people need to get into green space and they couldn't go to their regular park or their regular conservation area. So they found out that the Arboretum was open, and we had people coming here from Brampton or Toronto or London, like all over the place, because they heard, oh, it's open and you can go on hikes there. And that just shows how important we are. So it's a pretty, it's a great space. Mm-hmm. And I just want everyone to know it.
Yeah, like, even with, like, the university's focus, like while doing research in the archives, it was, like, fascinating to see, like, there used to be, like, Shakespeare in the park.
Yeah.
So there's, like, that's, like, the arts, like, that's the arts focus, and there's also, like, genetics, so, like, science focus. Oh, yeah. So it covers all the areas that's, like, in the university, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. I gotta go soon. Sorry.
Okay, okay. All right, so these are just, like, the follow-up questions. So what elements of the Arboretum are the most important to preserve?
Sorry, what?
What elements of the Arboretum are the most important?
I mean, all the elements, really. But most of it is our space. We just can't have the Arboretum be developed. Because once it becomes something else, it's not going to go back, right? And so that's what we have to make sure, that we're not a parking lot, that the space here is being utilized for Arboretum-focused activities. Or things like Nokum's house that's linked to the Arboretum. So thoughtful projects like that are great, but thoughtless projects, we just have to stop them from happening here. We can't be encroached upon just because we're here, and that keeps happening to us. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. We can't do what we do if we don't have the space to do it. And just because it makes sense for something to be developed here because it's close to the campus and we have all the space, is not, that has to stop. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to let it happen anymore, because we have the Turfgrass Institute, and it should not have been put in an arboretum. Mm-hmm. And that's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous that the university didn't think we were important enough to preserve what we have, and that can't happen again.
Yep.
It's not going to happen again while I'm here.
All right, just to end off on one final question that's open-ended. Yep. Have you heard any stories or legends about the Arboretum?
Ooh, I haven't heard any actual legends. That's cool. But I get lots of stories from different, you know, past students type of thing. But
I'm really curious about the seals.
Oh, yeah, okay. So when I was a student here, you could walk down the Arboretum promenade, and by the seal ponds, there were seals. So you could actually go to the fence and see the seals. So that's not part of the Arboretum. It's part of zoology department, and they had big ponds, and that's where they kept their seals in the summertime.
Where were the ponds?
So there, you can't see them now because we've got trees growing all the way around them. Mm-hmm. But they don't have seals in them now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I was an undergrad student, you could go there, or you'd be talking to someone and then you'd hear seals in the background barking and stuff like that.
So is it on like the east side of the promenade, or like the west?
It's on, yeah. So it's on sort of the south side of the promenade. Uh-huh. So as you're walking
it's really close
down,
to campus?
It's closer to the campus. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's not too far from the kiosk. But yeah, so there used to have, see, at one point, supposedly there was a polar bear there. I think his name was Harvey. But it's sort of weird, right? That history of that mm-hmm. type of thing is mm-hmm. is pretty neat. That mm-hmm. I can remember the seals being here and like, oh, let's go look at the seals.
Yeah, right? Apparently one time a seal escaped.
Yeah, so it escaped in the Arboretum, but it escaped into one of the ponds that they used for holding the water, and they couldn't get it out because of course they'd go to one end and then the seal would swim to the other end, and then they'd uh-huh. go to that end of the seal. So it couldn't get away. But it took them a long time to be able to capture it and get it back into the enclosure that it was supposed to be in, which is kind of fun.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like also apparently like the Arboretum was like the leading, university for seal research in the 1970s.
Oh yeah. No, like they did all kinds of, a friend of mine mm-hmm. actually, she did her master's on developing a birth control pill for seals, because they were talking, everyone was all up in arms that the seals were eating all the cod, when really it had nothing to do with the seals. It had all to do with us overfishing, right? And so they were trying to reduce the seal populations, and they thought, well, if we can develop a birth control pill for the seals, that might reduce the seal populations without people going out and clubbing baby seals, which was a, you know, obviously a very public issue at the time. And so, yeah, that was what she did her master's on, was developing.
Did the pill go anywhere?
It didn't. I don't think it was ever deployed, but she did come up with a pill that worked for seals. And she used the university seals for that project.
I feel like the seals are a legend of the Bermuda. Yeah,
no, so that's right. You're right. Yeah. Seals would be a good legend. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
All right. So that's the end of my interview. And so thank you so much for participating.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'll just end.